Well, I guess this evening we're going to see how well everyone was paying attention 2 weeks ago, and we're going to test your memory out a little bit, because we're going to pick up where we left off, kind of jog your memory. When I stopped the first part, we ended where, at that point, the Arab nations themselves weren't willing to commit their troops to any effort against the new state of the new Jewish state. The food situations throughout most of the Jewish settlements was desperate. And when I stopped, the first convoy that was supplying Jerusalem had been completely stopped. And with that, I'd like to continue on from that point. 9 miles south of Jerusalem lived the 450 men and women of Kfar at Zion, which constituted the southernmost anchor of Jerusalem's defenses. So exposed was their position, however, that they had lived in a state of quasi-siege since the United Nations vote of partition. Many had recommended the abandoning of the settlement, but the settlers' determination and the desire of the Haganah and the Jewish agency to yield no more land than was absolutely necessary kept them there. Abraham had grazed his flocks on Kfar at Zion's ridges. David had marched past this place on his way to the conquest of Jerusalem and the unification of the tribes of Judah and Israel. Jehoshaphat's warriors had gathered in the little vale above which the settlement was perched to give thanks for their victory over the Moabites and deed it its name, the Valley of Raca. Ancient spawning ground for the chief's Hebrew nation, the hills had become over the centuries the stronghold of a deeply felt and often violent Arab nationalism. In Hebron to the south, 66 Jews, most of them helpless yeshiva scholars, had been slaughtered during the Mufti-inspired riots of 1929. The survivors had struggled back, but a fresh outburst in 1936 had finally driven the last Jews from the city that sheltered the tomb of the father of the Hebrew people and had ended its centuries-old tradition as a center of Jewish learning. The four interrelated colonies which now constituted the settlement of Kfar Zion represented a fragile effort to reestablish a Jewish foothold in the southern buttress of Jerusalem. It had been a difficult enterprise. To the Arabs of Hebron, Kfar Zion was an alien intrusion on ground that had been wholly Arab for centuries. The colony's struggle to survive was a vital illustration of that unique institution sired by the Zionist return to Palestine, the kibbutz. The land had been first bought in 1928 from an Arab sheikh by a group of Orthodox Jews from Jerusalem. Their tentative efforts to settle it were abandoned after the Hebron massacres of 1929. A wealthy citrus grower from Rehovot purchased the land. He added a few further tracts acquired from nearby Arab villagers and settled 40 workers on it to lay foundation for a fruit plantation. But once again, an Arab uprising, this one in 1936, ended the Jewish settlement. To prevent the land from falling back into Arab hands, the Jewish National Fund took it over from the disillusioned citrus grower. And in 1942, by a complex legal maneuver, the fund circumvented the restrictions on Jewish land purchases set out by the British government's 1939 white paper and acquired the land of a nearby German monastery whose monks had been interned as enemy aliens by the British. On an April night 1 year later, 3 women and 10 men slipped through the darkness to lay claim to the monastery and officially establish the settlement of Kfar Zion. Those first settlers were Orthodox Jews, members of a movement founded in Poland and dedicated to combining a rigorous observance of the precepts of the Torah with collective existence. Its members had earned the title deeds of Kfar Zion's inhospitable ridges with 7 years of backbreaking labor clearing the land in Samaria. "Our fellow Jews are experiencing a horrible fate in Europe," they wrote on that night when, almost as conspirators, they came to claim their land. "With efforts, we will build a haven for those who survive," they concluded. This prophecy proved accurate. 2 years later, 60 emaciated men and women arrived at Kfar Zion to begin a new life alongside its original settlers. As a spiritual bond had united its first pioneers, so a physical one linked the new arrivals. The dark blue concentration camp numbers tattooed onto their flesh. Akiva Levi, a 19-year-old Czech, had finished his education at 13 and spent his adolescence staring at the gas chamber doors of a Sicilian death camp. Blonde Zipporah Rosenfeld was one of Auschwitz survivors. Nathaniel Steinberg's memory was still haunted by the images of the destruction of Warsaw's ghetto. To Yishak Ben Siria, one of Etz Zion's original founders, their arrival ended a bitter personal pilgrimage. At the war's end, Ben Siria had left Palestine for Europe to seek the survivors of his family and of 12 brothers and sisters. He found five. Four of them had come back with him to reimplant the Ben Siria family in the hills of Hebron. A grueling existence awaited the newcomers. In the winter, a cutting wind tore at Kfarat Zion slopes, sometimes wrapping them in a dank shroud of mist. By summer, a harsh sun seared the moisture from the land and stifled the settlers in their primitive shelters. There was no water. For 2 years, the kibbutzniks survived on the wintertime hoardings of the monastery cistern, sacrificing to their withered plants the water that their own bodies craved. Each acre had to be cleared by hand and with the help of four mules, and the spare topsoil terraced with a complex series of stone walls to prevent the winter rains from carrying it away. Soon it became apparent that fruit trees and vineyards were the only crops that the rocky soil could sustain. Planting their first orchards, the settlers paused to dedicate themselves and their saplings to the pledge drafted by one of their number. "We have taken this oath upon settling in Kfarat Zion," they solemnly intoned. "We shall not rest or know peace until we cast off the shame of barrenness from these highlands, until we shall cover them with fruit and forest trees." Even the Orthodox faith that united the settlers added its special problems to those that nature had given them. A complex system had to be devised so that their cows could be milked on the Sabbath without human labor. Almond roots grafted onto apple trees took hold more readily than in Almond roots grafted onto apple trees took hold more readily on their unpromising land. But as the Bible enjoined men against grafting alien roots, a special rabbinical dispensation was required before the settlers could employ the technique. Since the Torah specifically prohibited harvesting fruit trees during the first 4 years of their life, the settlers were forced to find a non-agricultural source of income. In spring and summer, they moved back into their tents and rented their stone huts to Jerusalemites anxious for a spell in the country. Despite all those obstacles, the settlers steadily developed their kibbutz. As their number grew, they established three satellite colonies called Musalt, Ein Tursum, and Revidim. The four interdependent settlements were known as the Etz Zion Bloc. The partition vote on November 29, 1947, greeted with so much joy by their fellow Jews elsewhere in Palestine, was welcomed with mixed feelings by the settlers of Kfarat Zion. The kibbutz that they had labored so hard to build would not be part of the new Jewish state. It had been assigned to its Arab neighbor. The decision had marked the beginning of a cruel winter. Well aware of the menace that the settlement posed to their lines of communications, persuaded correctly that Kfarat Zion had been settled for military as well as agricultural reasons, the Arabs lost no time in attacking it. Within a fortnight after the vote, a convoy en route to the colony was ambushed outside Bethlehem. 10 of its 26 passengers were killed and all its vehicles lost. Since that date, Kfarat Zion had been in a virtual state of siege. In January, women with young children were escorted back to Jerusalem by the British. Shortly after they left, the Arabs launched a concentrated attack on the colony. They were thrown back in a day of bitter fighting, but that night in the Nuvi Ovidea, the house of God's worker, which served as the kibbutz's synagogue and commercial center, someone recorded in the settlement's diary, "A series of miracles saved us today, but how long can we hold out? We are a tiny island in a stormy sea of Arabs." 4 days later, the stone floor of the Nuvi Ovidea served as the improvised morgue to receive the mutilated bodies of 35 Haganah men wiped out trying to reach the colony from Jerusalem. It was the worst defeat the Haganah had yet suffered at the Arab hands. As winter stretched toward spring, the settlers and the Palamak men who had been assigned to the colony lay aside their farm tools to cover their barren land with slit trenches, crude stone pillboxes, and barbed wire. They prepared a primitive landing strip, and the isolated settlement became one of the first beneficiaries of the Haganah Air Service byword, "Salvation comes from the sky." Still, the settlers' Spartan existence had its compensations. Their fields burst into an incredibly beautiful carpet of flowers with the arrival of spring. Each evening, Yashkaba Ben Syria and his rediscovered brothers and sisters wandered the fields together, stuffing their knapsacks with scarlet and then. I asked Luis how to say this, and I'm going to mess it up again. How did you say that?
Anemones.
Lavender, cyclamen, and golden buttercups. Purim arrived, and without their children to perform for them, the settlers staged the Purim play themselves. That evening, when the play was over, they stood together in the Nueva Obedia and drank together Lekayim, the toast of life. Never again would that toast have the same meaning for the settlement that it had that night. Springtime upon them was the spring of Kfaret Zion's first harvest. After the Arabs had completely stopped had succeeded in completely stopping the first convoy to Jerusalem, while the Arabs were busy celebrating their accomplishment and relishing the treasures that they had carried off from the convoy, apparently little thought was given to the fact that the Jews might just be determined enough to try the same failed attempt the next day. And as a result, the following day, the Haganah were able to push 60 trucks up the road to Jerusalem. They're almost completely unopposed, with only a few rifle shots from a few surprised Arab snipers along the way. The result was that they had almost all the trucks and armored cars and buses used to keep the road to Jerusalem open, concentrated in the holy city. It placed a crucial decision before the city's commanders. Should they try to run a convoy to Kfaret Zion in a massive effort to resupply the tiny settlement? There were many arguments both for and against the attempt. It was finally decided that Kfaret Zion was the bastion holding Jerusalem from an attack from the south. They would have to try and maintain it. The convoy would rush 200 tons of supplies and a 136-man relief force to the settlement. Almost every vehicle at Jerusalem's command's disposal would be used. A barricade buster, a crane, 4 armored buses, 40 trucks, 19 armored cars. And to protect it was sent the best of Jerusalem's arms. 18 machine guns, 2 mortars, 47 modern rifles, and 45 submachine guns. It would leave Jerusalem almost defenseless. It was decided that 2 elements would be crucial for the attempt's success: speed and surprise. To ensure speed, it was decided that the convoy could spend no more than 15 minutes in Kfaret Zion unloading. It would take the Arabs less than an hour to have thousands of men sending stones rolling down the road to block its return. Therefore, the settlement's occupants would line the roadway so that the supplies could be thrown from the back of the trucks before the convoy had even come to a stop. To ensure the element of surprise, the convoy would do something without precedent. It would leave Saturday morning. They would run the convoy to Kfaret Zion during the Sabbath. As the convoy prepared to leave, a finger pointed at a map to a point just beyond Solomon's Pools, where the road narrowed to a bend lined by a high wall. The convoy commander was told, "Here is where the Arabs are going to try to get you." As the convoy left, it was unimpeded but not unobserved. Already the message was traveling from village to village, calling men to arms. The Mufti's lieutenant in Jerusalem estimated that he would need 2 hours to set the trap. In Jerusalem, the news of the convoy's progress was received by wireless radio. The unloading had gone exactly as planned, but as the 15-minute allocation passed, there was no news of the convoy that the convoy was returning. Two unexpected problems delayed the convoy's departure. The first was an order sent to Kfaret Zion from Tel Aviv that the convoy was to bring back with them a small plane that had crashed on the primitive landing strip there a few days prior while trying to deliver supplies. The second problem was caused by the sudden and stubborn refusal of the only member of the settlement authorized to leave with the convoy. Despite frantic efforts of dozens of settlers, Zimra, the Kfaret Zion seed bull, refused to enter the truck destined to take him to a sniper-free pasture in the plains of Sharon. While 60 vehicles and 200 men waited on a reluctant bull and a broken airplane, the call to arms spread with feverish excitement to every corner of the Hebron Hills. In new cars, in creaking jalopies, on horseback, by mule, and by foot, hundreds and then thousands of Arabs streamed to the roadway leading from Kfaret Zion back to Jerusalem. With rifles and trouser pockets stuffed with ammunition, they rush to the road, honking car horns and fiercely firing their weapons to the sky. Finally, the radio in Jerusalem cracked the message that the convoy was on its way. It had taken 2 hours. As Lieutenant Irakat traveled the roadway, he could not believe the sight before him. The hills were alive with people screaming, shouting, firing guns, and throwing rocks and trees and anything else they could find onto the road. But he didn't have time to try and organize them, for he would let them inflict as much damage as they could. He had to get to the spot that he had selected for his ambush and organize the people there. As the convoy approached the barricade ahead of them, there was a silent tension felt throughout the vehicles. The barricade buster cut through the first Arab barricade, and then the second, and then the third. The tensions began to ease. Three more barricades were successfully pushed aside. As the convoy rounded a bend in the road, ahead was the seventh and largest barricade they had yet encountered. Under a steady Arab fire, the barricade buster moved up to attack the boulders. Suddenly, without warning, a rock slide rolled off the side of the hill surrounding the road onto the blockade buster. The heavy truck trembled an instant and then tumbled over on its side into a ditch. Behind it, the convoy came to a halt. A sheet of Arab fire poured onto the stalled vehicles. The roar of gunfire now punctuated with the report of exploding tires. The trap was shut. "Where are you?" Jerusalem radioed the convoy. "Neba Daniel," came the reply. At those words, those of the Jerusalem command sank into their seats. Neba Daniel was the name of an old Arab house. It sat on a hillside just beyond Solomon's Pools, at the exact spot that had been indicated to the convoy commander 4 hours earlier on his map. With no hope of breaking through the barricade, the convoy commander ordered those vehicles it could to return to Kfaret Zion. It was already too late for most. Only 5 armored cars carrying 35 men and 5 trucks managed to return to the settlement. One of them was the truck carrying Zimra, the seed bull, whose stubbornness had helped delay the convoy's departure. The remaining 185 men and women caught in the trap saw as their only hope the stone house for which their ambush site was named. They circled the building with as many vehicles as could be moved, too deep, as the early pioneers of America had circled their wagons against attack from Indians. Jerusalem had nothing left with which to help those trapped at Neba Daniel. They had risked everything in the convoy. With no other option, they asked the British for help. The British commander and his deputy were gone to Athens, having left a junior officer in charge. After all, it was the Sabbath. Nothing would happen. When the Haganah contacted him, he was already in a dilemma. He had already been reprimanded for having allowed such a large convoy into Arab territory. He told the Haganah that they had got themselves into this mess and they'd have to get themselves out. After hanging up the phone, he knew that he'd have to do something, but what? Already in trouble for having allowed the situation to arise, if he sent British troops in and British lives were lost, he would have even more problems. If he sent British aid in without loss of life, there would be an instant uprising among the Arabs because they had helped the Jews. If he did nothing and allowed the Jews and Neba Daniel to be slaughtered, there would be repercussions. Contacting the Mufti's Jerusalem command, he was informed that the only way the British would be allowed in was if all the Jews were given to the Arabs as prisoners. He knew that there was no way that the Haganah would or could agree to that. After many hours of debate, he came up with a plan that the Arabs would agree to, and the best that he could offer to the Haganah. Feeling that they had no other option, the Jewish command sadly accepted the British offer. With the batteries and the convoy's radios already dead, there was no way to notify them of the plan. The men and women of Neba Daniel had fought all day and throughout the night. The floor of their retreat was strewn with the bodies of dead and wounded and covered with blood and spent shells. The few survivors were exhausted as in the morning light of the next morning, Easter Sunday, they saw the British armored column and Red Cross ambulances. Slowly, the Arab gunfire diminished as the British fired warning shots at those not so willing to give up the victory that they sensed was theirs. As the British escorted ambulances rounded a curve, Jacques de Renier of the Red Cross suddenly saw the house, which he would later record in his log, as small and alone in the middle of hell. On the road leading up to it, he noted a sprawl of shattered and blackened vehicles and burnt bodies, their heads and sexual organs carefully mutilated. The British officer presented their terms to the survivors in the little building. They would escort out all the people and their dead and wounded, But all their equipment, vehicles, guns, ammunition, radios, etc., were to be left for the Arabs to do with as they willed. They had only 3 minutes to prepare to move. While the wounded were hurriedly prepared to move, others smashed and destroyed as many radios and arms as they could. They had completely lost all their means with which to supply and to defend Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem was officially under siege. With the road leading to it tightly closed, and the Haganah had no way to reopen it. The food which had already been in short supply for the Jewish residents of Jerusalem now disappeared at an alarming rate. On Monday, March 29, 1948, all that was left was a 5-day supply of margarine, 4 days of macaroni, and 10 days of dried meat. There was no fresh meat, fruits, or vegetables available, and there was only enough flour to make enough bread to provide 6 slices per Jewish resident. There had been no kerosene for cooking since February, and the Jewish housewives had been using DDT as a cooking fuel. The conditions had grown so unbearable that something which before had been unheard of was occurring. The Christian denominations of Jerusalem, in complete agreement, signed a petition to the United Nations for an international police force for the city, probably the only time that the august heads of those communities had ever agreed on anything. But it received no more attention than the many previous such requests made by the Jewish agency for the United Nations to protect the people of the city, which they now claim to be the governing body of. Throughout Palestine, the Haganah were now on the defensive, just trying to hold on to what they could with what little they had. It was decided that they could no longer operate in secret in hopes of waiting until the British left. The Haganah would have to cut off its techniques of an underground army and operate for the first time in the open, in strength, in pursuit of precise and geographic objectives. They would have to fight all that would oppose them, whether they be Arab, British, or otherwise. Throughout Palestine, the little Jewish villages were left with only a token force to defend them, as the rest were transported to Tel Aviv. In Europe, Ehud Areviel, the buyer sent by the Haganah to purchase weapons and to store them throughout Europe, stared solemnly at the telegraph before him. It contained only one word, but it told him how desperate things were in his homeland. It was the code word for him to begin smuggling as many arms into Palestine as he could, as fast as he could, in any manner he could find, and at any cost. He knew that it meant the situation was grave, to risk losing those arms to the British inspections. The plan before the Haganah rested on a simple strategy. Since it was clear that the road could not be reopened by ramming bigger convoys through, they would try to temporarily establish a Jewish-held corridor on both sides of the road, 6 miles wide on the plains and 1 to 2 miles broad on the hills beyond. That belt of land would encompass the dozens of Arab villages upon whose support Abdul Qaeda Husseini depended on for his campaign to close the road. Once in control, they would have to immediately destroy the villages, leaving no stone unturned, so that if the ground were lost in the future, the Arabs would have no basis from which to operate. Shimon Avidan, the commander of the Palmach Gevadi Brigade, looked at the recruits that were arriving for his command. Many were young recruits just out of training. He would later recall that they were like kids on a youth move. They were like kids on a youth movement outing. They came with their suitcases and boxes. They were romantic boys and girls. They carried no ammunition, but they had their possessions in small cases. The girls all with their books of Raquel, the poetress of the Kinneret. As they arrived and were lined up and informed that henceforth each person would carry just one knapsack, they were instructed to decide what you want, flowers or your clothes. Some of the girls started crying. He would recall, in a few days with these kids, 10 rifles and 4 machine guns, I'm going to have to go to war for the road to Jerusalem. The Arabs of Beit Daras had shown little interest in the airstrip left by the RAF as the British prepared to leave Palestine. They had cut up the runway, destroyed the control tower, and there was no electricity, no fuel pump, and no radio, as to ensure its lack of usability. But in early April, a column of trucks arrived with lights out, and men began to hurriedly repair the landing strip in the cover of darkness, while others took up defensive positions around the strip. In 2 hours, there was electricity from a portable generator, dozens of jerry cans of aviation fuel were stacked in the hangars, and a control tower consisting of a portable radio transmitter in the back of a truck were ready to receive the first of Ehud Areviel's smuggled arms shipment. Tonight, deep in Arab-held territory, they awaited the sound of the dilapidated DC-4, bringing 140 Czech M-34 machine guns and thousands of rounds of ammunition. In Tel Aviv, the British custom inspectors only needed to open the hold of the tramp steamer SS Nora. The stench of the rotting onions verified the Nora's manifest of onions. Crying like babies, the Haganah dug through the piles of onions for the thousands of Czech rifles and machine guns hidden in the pile of rotting onions. Only 60 of the estimated 300 trucks needed to run the first convoy into Jerusalem. Only 60 of the estimated 300 trucks needed to run the first convoy through Jerusalem had been located. And so throughout Palestine, trucks were being hijacked by gunpoint for the mission. Because most of the trucks were owned by their drivers and were their livelihood, they were not about to abandon them. And so the drivers as well as the trucks were there as they were needed. Crucial to their plan to open the road to Jerusalem was the capture of the Arab village of Castile. Throughout history, the promontory had been a strategic height, the natural guardian of Jerusalem's approaches. After an intense battle, a small band of Haganah soldiers managed to secure the village. However, as word spread of Castile's fall, Arabs from miles around came to reclaim the town. Under the direction of the Mufti's Kamil Irkat, they were on the verge of retaking the town when Irkat was wounded. Irkat knew well the psychology of his village warriors. Products of a hierarchical structure of their villages, they tended to magnify the importance of their leader, to erect around his person a kind of cult. Guided by an able man, those villages were capable of great acts of bravery. Without a galvanic presence to rally them, however, their organization risked rapid disintegration. Over Irkat's loud protest, the medic strapped him onto a mule for the trip back to Jerusalem. As Irkat had feared it would, as the Haganah braced themselves for the Arabs' final assault, suddenly they saw their foes start to wander off the battlefield. They were going home. Castile was firmly in Jewish hands. In Tel Aviv, the 300 trucks were being loaded by stevedores from the docks in the port of Tel Aviv. Working like an automatic conveyor belt, they were loading one truck every 5 minutes. As the last of the trucks was being loaded, the first were starting on their journey through the darkness to Jerusalem, all of their lights having been removed in case an anxious driver might try to turn his lights on, either intentionally or by accident. Each truck was fitted with tow hooks and a steel cable so that any truck could tow one that faltered or be towed if itself need be. Ahead of the convoy was the sound and the flashes of light from the battle that was opening the road for them. As word spread throughout Jerusalem that a convoy was coming through, people packed the roadway to watch it come in. No supplies had reached the city in 2 weeks. The ration for each person for the past 2 weeks had been 2 ounces of margarine, 1/4 pound of potatoes, and 1 pound of dried meat. That was their ration for a week. There probably was not one there that would not always remember the sight of that first truck. Someone had painted on the bumper 6 words, "If I forget thee, O Jerusalem." Elsewhere, the Jews were also having success. A storm had driven the tramp steamer SS Lino into an Italian port of Malfetta. There, an Italian customs inspector had discovered the 6,000 Czech rifles and 8 million rounds of cartridges aboard. They were headed for the Arab Liberation Army, but Italian officials feared that they might actually be destined to the Italian Communist Party to help foment an anti-government rising, and they seized the ship. While the ship was impounded in port, the Haganah were able to place explosives on the vessel's hull and sink both it and its cargo. They were also having success in building their air force. Although it was diverse, the planes already purchased, they had been able to purchase 3 more Constellations, 10 more C-46s, 5 Mustangs, 3 B-17 Flying Fortresses, 25 Norseman transports, 4 Buha fighters, and 10 Messerschmitt 109s. Although enjoying some small successes, the Jews were in for a few setbacks. The Arabs had reorganized and were making a major attempt to retake Castile and again close the road to Jerusalem. After 4 days of intense fighting, the Jews defending the city were exhausted and falling asleep while firing their weapons. And soon, with their ammunition exhausted, they were forced to withdraw, dragging and carrying their dead and wounded with them as best they could. However, once the Arabs were in Castile, they found among the dead their leader, Abdul Qader Husseini. Men swarmed around the body, weeping and shrieking their grief and kissing the dead leader's face. Others smashed their heads with the stock of their rifles to mark their remorse. Abdul-Kader was gently placed on a stretcher, his face washed and clothes straightened out. Then passed from hand to hand, he was carried down the hillside of his last conquest. From throughout Palestine, Arabs came to Jerusalem for Abdul-Kader's funeral. Signaled by the wildest outburst of gunfire Jerusalem had yet heard, the waste is appalling, thought Anwar Nusaybeh. They're firing off enough ammunition to conquer half of Palestine. Emil Gori thought that he was witnessing the end of the Palestine resistance movement. He would say, "There is something in our blood," he thought, "that ascribes such importance to the man, such hero worship to the leader, that when he dies, everything collapses." And collapse it did as suddenly the Haganah found themselves in a war without a foe. As village after village emptied, as the Arab people swarmed to Jerusalem to be with their fallen leader. And in fact, Castile, at which their leader had lost his life in the taking of, was now almost deserted. The Haganah retook the village for which they had fought so hard for and lost in battle without firing a shot. While violence and chaos were the rule for most of Palestine, there was peace in one Arab village just outside of Jerusalem. The little village was called Deir Yassin, and for years the village inhabitants had cultivated friendly relations with their Jewish neighbors. They went to each other's feasts, and they danced and sang together over cups of coffee and glasses of arak. Even in that troubled springtime of 1948, the village remained a calm oasis at the gates of Jerusalem. With quiet but firm resolve, they had kept the Mufti's men from their peaceful village, and their neutrality had been respected by both sides. There had been absolutely no reports of any Jewish casualties or harassments from the town, but their peace was about to be violently ended. Not all members of the Jewish communities were supportive of the Jewish agency or the Haganah or the manner in which they were handling things. They did not like the UN proposal, nor did they accept the internationalization of Jerusalem. They felt that all of Palestine was theirs to take by any means available, and their terrorist practices had cost the Jews of Palestine a lot of world support. Before the UN vote, they had already a long list of bloodshed to their credit. Broken into two groups, they were known as the Stern and the Irgun gangs. On July 22, 1946, they were responsible for the deaths of 90 people, Arabs, Britons, and Jews, when they blew up a wing of the King David Hotel. Later, they shocked the world and outraged their fellow Jews by hanging two British sergeants and then booby-trapping their bodies in reprisal for the execution of one of their number. Their excesses were largely responsible for the anti-Jewish sentiment which permeated the British forces in Palestine. Shortly after the UN vote to partition Palestine, they had thrown bombs into a crowd of Arab shoppers at Damascus Gate, killing 6 people and wounding 40 more. Later, they bombed a group waiting at a bus stop. Their next target was the peaceful little village of Deir Yassin. Although peaceful, the residents of the village put up a gallant fight against their attackers, holding them off for over 2 hours. But soon their ammunition, of which they had no intention of using in such a fashion, was exhausted. Among the first to fall to the slaughter were 33 people driven from their homes and lined up against a wall and shot. Among those killed was a couple just married the day before. They died with their hands clasped together. 12-year-old Fahima Zaidan, one of the few survivors of that killing, explained, "The Jews ordered all of our families to line up against the wall, and they started shooting us. I was hit in the side, but most of us children were saved because we hid behind our parents. The bullets hit my sister Kadria, age 4, in the head, my sister Sema, age 8, in the cheek, and my brother Muhammad, 7, in the chest. But all the others with us against the wall were killed, my father, my mother, my grandfather, my grandmother, my uncles, my aunts, and some of their children." Halim Eid, a young woman of 30, belonging to one of Deir Yassin's principal families, declared that she saw a man shoot a bullet into the neck of my sister Salia, who was 9 months pregnant. Then he cut her stomach open with a butcher's knife. She said that another woman witnessing the same scene, Aush Rabas, was killed when she tried to extricate the unborn infant from the mother's womb. At another house, Naina Khalil, 16, claimed that she saw a man take a kind of sword and slash my neighbor Jamil Hish from head to toe, and then do the same thing on the steps to the house of my cousin Fatih. Similar scenes took place in house after house. The survivors' accounts indicated that the female members of the commando groups matched the savagery of their male counterparts. Bit by bit, Deir Yassin was submerged into a commotion of screams, exploding grenades, and the stench of blood and gunpowder and smoke. Its assailants killed, they looted, and finally they raped. Safiya Etiya, a 41-year-old woman, reported that as a man jumped on her, she screamed, but she reported, "But other women around me were also being raped. Some of the men were so anxious to get our earrings that they ripped our ears to pull them off faster." By mid-morning, they began dynamiting the buildings from which there was still resistance. Jacques de Renier, the Swiss representative of the International Red Cross, led the first party to reach the site. It did not take him long to discover that Deir Yassin was in the hands of men with whom he had no previous contact. Only the intervention of an enormous German-born member of the Irgun, who told Renier that he owed his life to the Red Cross, got the Swiss past the dissident sentries. The spectacle awaiting him made Renier gasp. "The first thing I saw, in his words, "the first thing I saw were people running everywhere, rushing in and out of houses, carrying stun guns, rifles, pistols, and long ornate Arab knives. As he would write later in his diary, they seemed half mad. I saw a beautiful girl carrying a dagger still covered with blood. I heard screams. We're still mopping up," my German friend explained. "All I could think of were the SS troops I'd seen in Athens." And then, to his horror, Renier noted that he saw a young woman stab an elderly man and woman cowering on the doorstep of their hut. Still dazed by the sight, Renier pushed his way into the first house he reached. "Everything had been ripped apart and torn upside down," he wrote. "There were bodies strewn about. They had done their cleaning up with guns and grenades and finished their work with knives. Anyone could see that." He suddenly saw something move in the shadows. Bending down, he discovered a little foot, still warm. It belonged to a 10-year-old girl, still alive despite her wounds. Renier picked her up and ordered his German escort to carry her to an ambulance. Then he furiously demanded that he be allowed to continue his search for wounded. He found two more, an elderly woman half paralyzed with fear, hiding behind a woodpile, and a dying man. In all, he estimated he had seen 200 corpses. One of them belonged, his diary would record, to a woman who must have been 8 months pregnant, hit in the stomach with powder burns on her dress indicating that she'd been shot point blank. Embarrassed by Rainier's presence, the Irgun and Stern leaders finally ordered him back to Jerusalem with the wounded that he had managed to save from the ruins. There, the survivors of the massacre were being paraded through the streets by their captors. Harry Levine saw three trucks drive slowly up and down King George V Avenue, carrying men and women and children, their hands held over their heads. As word of the slaughter spread, most of Jewish Palestine was horrified at the news. Eliyahu Aurelia led the nearest Haganah group, a youth group, into Deir Yassin. There he found what was, in his words, to be absolutely barbaric. "All the killed, with very few exceptions," he remarked, "were old men, women, or children." There was never any question in Aurelia's mind that the dead we found were all unjust victims, and none of them had died with a weapon in their hands. So appalling was the scene that Irieli refused to allow his youngsters into the village to witness it. Instead, he set to cleaning it up with his officers. A large group of Haganah men followed the youth division already there and surrounded the dissidents. Unwilling to surrender to the Haganah men around them, they forced the Haganah leaders to contact Jerusalem command for instructions. Their orders were that if they didn't lay down their weapons, open fire and kill them all. Yeshurun Shif, who received those orders, couldn't bring himself to carry them out. Reasoning that the Arabs would be outraged by the action and killing the dissident Jews in front of him wouldn't change those hostilities that he was sure would follow. Jews killing Jews would only cause division among themselves, which they could little afford. Few Jewish prisoners in the months ahead would not hear the vengeful scream of Deir Yassin, and many would reach their own graves in retribution for the dissident's crime. The overwhelming majority of the Jews in Palestine reacted to the Deir Yassin with shock and abhorrence. The Jewish agency immediately disassociated itself with the terrorist act and roundly condemned it. David Ben-Gurion personally cabled his shock at the incident to King Abdullah. The chief rabbi of Jerusalem took the extraordinary step of excommunicating the participants in the attack. But the news of the assault would bring great pressure from the Arab peoples, for their respective governments to take military action, and Jewish settlements throughout Palestine would find themselves under attack by Arab groups seeking to avenge those at Deir Yassin. For over a month, the bus that supplied the hospital and the university on Mount Scopus had been free of incident, and there was no reason to believe that the convoy of Tuesday, April 13th, would be any different. On board the vehicles, along with the medical supplies and research material, were an astonishing assembly of professors and doctors, researchers, scholars, and nurses. Suddenly, the lead car hit a mine, and the whole convoy came to a stop as hundreds and then thousands of infuriated Arabs swarmed down on the convoy. In their suffocating dark metal prisons, the passengers of the trapped convoy could hear from over the hail of gunfire raining down on them, the cries of Deir Yassin from outside. Despite dozens and dozens of calls from Jews, Arabs, and Britons alike, to the British for help to save the convoy, it would be over 6 hours before the called help would arrive. Meanwhile, a British officer, Colonel Churchill, who had come upon the attack, had made several gallant efforts to save the passengers of the convoy by driving his half-track through the Arab fire in an attempt to extract some of those trapped occupants of the dying convoy. Although heroic, his efforts would have little more success than his demand for troops to save the convoy. In the only armored car of the convoy, the first man killed had been the first aid man. Then one of their machine guns jammed. By now, half the men inside the car were dead or wounded. The floor was covered with blood and bodies. The survivors jumped from one side to the other to fire their Sten guns from the car's slits, stepping indiscriminately on them. If they shouted, you knew they were dead, Shafai Sanat grimly recalled. At the rear end of the car, the only machine gun working was being fed by a man who had already lost half a hand. The wounded, with no one to care for them, sat propped up against the sides of the car, slowly bleeding to death. The gunfire from the convoy trailing off to a trickle, the Arabs could now get close enough to hurl Molotov cocktails and hand grenades, turning many of the vehicles into infernos, many with people still alive inside. Finally, the order was given for the British troops to intervene. Of the estimated 100 people on that convoy, the British would only find 6 still alive. 24 of the bodies were so badly burned and/or mutilated that they never would be identified. The next morning, as Moshe Hillman picked through the ruins, he would remove a skull, an arm, a stethoscope, and a pair of glasses, among other things. And then the wreckage was turned over to the British demolition experts. The daily log of the Highland Light Infantry would state, the remaining vehicles were blown up to clear the road, and the road mended and reopened to traffic. The rage generated in the Arabs by the attack on Deir Yassin would cost the Jews of Palestine greatly. With a renewed vigor, the road to Jerusalem was again closed, and Jerusalem again was under siege. The Arab leaders, which had been reluctant to get involved militarily, were now under such intense public pressure to use their armies to drive Jews into the sea that it was inevitable that they would have to do so. Many Arab leaders feared being overthrown or assassinated if they didn't act. Having already expressed a desire to accept the plan of trusteeship proposed by the United States, they couldn't very well reject it now. So instead, they set conditions that they knew there was no way the United States or the United Nations could accept. They would consider a truce only if the Haganah were dissolved, the Stern and Irgun gangs disarmed, all Jewish immigration stopped, and all illegal Jewish immigrants in Palestine were deported. As for trusteeship, they would accept it only if it were exercised by the Arab states, not the United Nations. Having effectively killed the trusteeship plan for Palestine, the Arab states were now free to plan for war, and President Truman was now free to resume his support of partition and his support of the new Jewish state. Of all the Arab forces surrounding them, there was one that had the respect and the attention of the Haganah. That was the Arab Legion of Transjordan. Under the call of King Abdullah, they were all volunteers, tightly disciplined, well-trained, and with combat experience. They possessed anti-tank guns, field artillery, mortars, armored cars, and half-tracks, and were proficient with their use. It was from that body that came the 15-page typewritten document with accompanying maps for the invasion of Palestine that was before the Arab League. It called for a northern thrust by the Lebanese, Syrian, and Liberation armies. spearheaded by an Iraqi armored force to capture the port of Haifa, while a narrow southern thrust by the Egyptian army up the coastal plain would seize Jaffa. Thus, the new state would be deprived of its ports that it would need to bring in men and arms after the British left. At the same time, the Arab Legion and the balance of the Iraqi army would aim to cut the Jewish settlement in half by thrusting across the coastal plain from the Judean hills to the sea north of Tel Aviv. The campaign was to take 11 days. To implement it, the plan called for virtually all of Arab's armies to be placed under a supreme commander. If those forces, prepared or not, were made available, the plan had every chance of success. It was the stuff of which David Ben-Gurion's and the other Haganah leaders' nightmares were made of. The plan was praised by all those at the Arab League and quickly accepted. But instantly arose a conflict as to who should be the supreme commander of the new force. None of those present wanted to relinquish his authority to another, and the Arab Legion's Major Wasf Attell, who had drafted the plan and submitted it, and who was by far the most qualified to lead such an endeavor, wasn't even considered. After several days of heated debate over the issue, and after the conference was over, a British officer of the Arab Legion probably best stated the results when he was asked how the meeting had gone. His reply was, "Splendid. We've all agreed to fight separately." Jerusalem again under siege, a plea was once again addressed to the United Nations on the Holy City's behalf. It read, "Jerusalem should not be a problem of Jewish defense. It was the United States which took the lead together with France, Belgium, and Holland in urging the Jews to give up their claim to Jerusalem Jerusalem should not be a problem of Jewish defense. It was the United States which took the lead together with France, Belgium, and Holland in urging the Jews to give up their claim of Jerusalem, and that should be within their claim that Jew. I'm having a horrible time with this. In urging the Jews to give up their claim that Jerusalem should be within the borders of a Jewish state, on the grounds of the city's universal character and its association with Christianity and Islam, the Jews, after deep heart searching, made that sacrifice. It is now for the United Nations to fulfill the task for which they have undertaken." The request, having again yielded no response, all the previous requests had, posters began to appear around the Holy City. They announced the creation of an exclusively Jewish Jerusalem City Council. It was a logical consequence of the new Jewish position on Jerusalem, and it heralded the birth of one idea and the death of another. Internationalization was finished. Jerusalem would now belong not to the world, but to whoever had the strength to claim it. With the British withdrawal from Palestine only a few weeks away, and war looming on the horizon, there were decisions to be made by all parties. The United States was asking the Jews not to declare their statehood when the British left. There were several reasons for this. First, they had hoped that if the new Jewish state did not declare its independence, a truce might be arranged with the Arabs. Second, President Truman had already sent a top-secret memo to his legal advisor, Ernest Gross, for a brief on his executive power to order American soldiers into Palestine without waiting for congressional approval. If the Jewish agency refrained from proclaiming a state and the Arabs attacked, then the United States would have some justification for intervening on the grounds that she was aiding a group of individuals and not taking sides in a war between nations. If the agency persisted in declaring statehood, then they could expect no military support from the United States. If the Jewish agency announced their new state, the United States also had to decide if they would recognize it or wait. Again, President Truman's advisors were split on their opinions. The Jews of Jerusalem were faced with the job of occupying the British posts as soon as the Britons left and before the Arabs could take them. Their intelligence had obtained good information on their schedule for departure, but they lacked the number of people needed to accomplish it. Jewish workers in the city's vital installations were convinced to remain on the job until the British walked out so that they could hold the buildings for a few precious minutes until the Jewish troops could arrive to relieve them. Repairmen, typists, operators, often with no military training at all, they were labeled the Players' Brigade. After the firearm with which they would have to defend themselves while they waited for the Haganah soldiers, a box of Players' cigarettes stuffed with TNT and a crude detonator. 600 of those primitive hand grenades had been smuggled into the General Post Office, the Telephone Exchange, Barclays Bank, and the court buildings. Chief Justice Sir William Fitzgerald returned to his chambers, his belongings already packed. He hung his robe and his wig on their hook and cast a last glance at his legal volumes and his ornate gold inkstand and started out the door. He paused. Instead of shutting it, he left it open, the key hanging from its unturned lock for whoever would come to claim it. Thus, in hundreds of different offices in Jerusalem, did the British administration in Palestine begin to go through the last rites of a 30-year sojourn in the Holy Land. While the Britons were preparing to leave and people were killing each other in the streets, there would be no authority when the British left. Palestine would go to whoever had the strength to claim it. The United Nations Palestine Committee was arguing over the schedule for bus service in their new city. The situation in Jerusalem was critical as it faced an all-out war when the British departed. The food ration for each person for the week prior to the British departure was 3 ounces of dried fish, dried beans, lentils, and macaroni, and 1.5 ounces of margarine for an entire week. That same week, the Arabs cut the water supply to the city again. This time, the British would not repair it as they were to leave in a few days. The Jews of Jerusalem would have to live on the water that they had been able to save thus far, which was in more abundance than their food supply. It was decided, in order to avoid panic, it would be better to deliver water to the consumers rather than to have them come and get it. A team of civilian volunteers was mobilized to man the donkey and horse-drawn water tanks. Suddenly, there appeared in Jerusalem's Jewish neighborhoods regularly delivering to each householder a 3-day ration. They would be an institution. For weeks through the searing heat of summer, between bursts of Arab shellfire, Jerusalem's housewives would line up with their bottles, their tea kettles, saucepans, and milk cans to wait for the neighborhood donkey cart and their precious water ration. Jerusalem being Jerusalem, the city would not endure a siege without some manifestation of providence. In April, before the convoys had arrived to break the first blockade, a weed called kubitza had provided a miraculous relief to the hungry population. The spinach-like herb sprang up wild in the fields after spring rains. It was nutritious, filling, and full of vitamins. Women scoured the fields of the city looking for it, and before it disappeared, it had become popular in a dish called spinach croquettes. Then suddenly, just before the British left, a wholly unseasonable 3-day rain struck Jerusalem, bringing a new and totally unexpected crop of kubitza pushing up from the soil. To the Jerusalemites, it was taken as a sign that the Lord was with them. In household and synagogue, they would say, "The last time when we left Egypt, he sent us manna. This time he sent us rain for the cisterns and the kibbutzah." Throughout Palestine, the wealthy upper-class Arabs and the political leaders had already fled, preferring to lead their crusade against the Jews from a safe distance and to the armies and the common people of Palestine. With the British about to depart, the Arab population didn't want to be in the paths of their armies, which they expected to sweep through, and they began a mass exodus from Palestine. As the Arabs fled, they all thought it would be just for a few days until the Arab armies had pushed the Jews into the sea. And throughout Palestine, they left their homes with furniture covered with dust covers and valuables packed away, awaiting their owner's return. The Jews seized the opportunity and occupied as many buildings as they could, and increase their offensive efforts to encourage the movement. As Jamil Toucan would remember, after having fled to what he deemed to be a safe location, he remembered an item that he wished he had packed away at home. Telephoning his home in hopes that a neighbor would still be there and might answer the phone and attend to it for him, he was shocked when the voice on the other end of the line answered the phone, "Shalom." By early May, 65,000 of Jaffa's 70,000 Arabs had already fled. The Haganah had secured the cities of Tiberias, Haifa, Safed, and dozens of smaller towns and villages in Galilee. And so by thousands they fled, poor, bewildered people, clutching a few belongings in a cardboard box, a sack, a suitcase, carrying their crying young in their arms, in dilapidated buses whose roofs were crammed with their possessions, in taxis, on foot, on bicycles, on donkeys. They poured out of the country thinking that, unlike their Jewish neighbors, they had somewhere to go, vowing, "We shall come back." They were wrong. On Tuesday, May 11th, 4 days before the British mandate in Palestine expired, the Arab League voted to declare war on the as-of-yet still unborn Jewish state. Their lack of a central commander was causing great divisions already, and even within any one army there was problems. The royalty that headed each nation was used to just having everything they wanted right before them and had little understanding for preparing for the mission that they were about to undertake. They simply expected everything to happen because they willed it. The Egyptian army had already been told to prepare to take Palestine, and the army itself was ready, but they didn't have a single map of Palestine. Nor did they have any mobile kitchen or supply vehicles with either food or water for the men, or fuel or parts for their equipment. While the confused armies of the various Arab states tried to prepare for some kind of war, the only group prepared for it, the Arab Legion, was going to sit it out. King Abdullah of Transjordan and John Glubb, the British commander of his prized Arab Legion, both knew their Jewish state was inevitable, and if they conquered all of Palestine, world opinion would eventually force a portion to be given to the Jews. Secondly, each Arab force was operating separately, with each country's leader trying to increase his own dominion. And even if the Jews were defeated, there would be undoubtedly as big of a battle with fellow Arabs for control. Thirdly, the Arab Legion was trained for desert fighting, and John Glubb did not want to risk his men's lives fighting in the narrow streets and the alleyways, and from house to house and from rooftop to rooftop, as he knew that the Battle of Palestine would be fought. His men were not trained for that kind of fighting, and he did not wish to lose unnecessary lives for a conquest he knew that he would not be able to keep. The Arab Legion, therefore, would be deployed along the mountain ridges on the Arab side of the United Nations partition. If the situation collapsed in Jerusalem, they could move quickly in. If, as John Glubb suspected, the Jews drove the Arabs out of Jerusalem, his troops would ensure that they did not take any Arab land, a move that he knew the United Nations would have to support. However, not all people were quite as willing to see the Arab Legion sit the battle out. And as they were deploying along their lines, a false report was made that units were receiving fire from the settlement of Kfar at Zion. In return, they were given permission to attack the village as the reporter of the false report had hoped. There was nothing that the defenders of Kfar at Zion could do to stop the advancing armored column. Their rifles, pistols, and Molotov cocktails would have little effect against the artillery, the mortars, machine guns, and the armored cars of the Arab Legion. And the Legion rolled through the tiny village at a rapid pace, despite the furious opposition put up by its defenders. However, the noise and the commotion drew droves of Arab irregulars from the countryside, making it impossible for the Legion officers to keep their situation under control. There were literally thousands of them running everywhere. Forced to surrender, the 50 survivors of Kfar at Zion assembled in the little square before the headquarters. Before the Legion could get to them, scores of irregulars swarmed around them, shrieking, "Dir Yassan," ordering them to sit down, stand up, and to sit down again. Yasha ben Sira looked for the five brothers and sisters he had brought to Kfar at Zion from Europe's death camps. Only one, Nehum, was still alive. Suddenly a machine gun began to fire. Yaakov Edelstein saw bodies tumbling all around him. "It's the end," he thought. The sight of a bayonet plunged into a comrade's chest spurred him to action. With a leap, he sprang up from the mound of dying men and women and started a wild flight. Shoving his way past the startled Arab surrounding him, spurred by this gesture, half a dozen others followed in a wild, instinctive flight. There was no place to go, Edelstein recalled, because the whole area swarmed with Arabs. Nahum ben Syria stumbled, exhausted, into a little vineyard at the edge of the kibbutz, only a few paces from the path along which the Arabs raced up and down in search of loot and survivors. He would huddle there until nightfall, tense for the shout Yahud, which would precede a fatal burst of gunfire. Edelstein and three others crawled over the stone fence at the end of the settlement and darted into a little glade, called a Song of Songs because it was a favorite hideaway for the kibbutz's young in love. They burrowed among its boulders and closely spaced trees, hoping that somehow the boughs that had sheltered the trysts of their teenagers in love would now save their lives. Suddenly, a group of irregulars rushed up and threw Edelstein and Yitzchak ben Syria, who had hidden with him, against a wall. As the Arabs drew their knives, a pair of legionnaires came up and led the two to safety. As they were led off, they heard shots from the lover's glade. The irregulars had found the two others that had hid with them. Eliza Futschwanger had thrown herself into a ditch behind the school with half a dozen others. The Arabs rushed the ditch and began to empty their Sten guns at the hapless survivors inside. A piercing shriek from Eliza interrupted their slaughter just long enough to allow one of them to yank her from the trench. A knot of men surrounded her, disputing the privilege of raping her with the Arab who had pulled her from the ditch. Finally, two of them dragged her away from the others and pushed her screaming through the smoking ruins of the kibbutz to a clump of wood. There they began to claw at her, tearing her clothing, unable to agree who would assault her first. Suddenly, two bursts of gunfire interrupted their fight. Eliza saw the two Arabs drop dead at her feet. Stunned, she looked up and found before her an Arab Legion officer, smoke still curling from the mouth of his Sten gun. Lieutenant Nawaf Yabra el-Humund took a piece of bread from his pocket. "Eat this," he said. When she had done so, he told her, "Now you are under my protection," and marched her to his armored car. Nahum ben Syria, Yishak ben Syria, Yaakov Edelstein, and Eliza Fuchswanger were the only four survivors of the 152 member of the settlement of Kfarat Zion. The settlers of the three satellite communities, Masat, Ein Surim, and Rebidim, had helplessly watched the slaughter. Smaller and less well-armed and protected, they grimly awaited their turn. However, the Arab Legion would not take part in their defeat. Convinced that they had eliminated any threat from the settlement, they wanted to get to their positions before the British mandate expired. Soon, the only sound in the kibbutz was the shrieks of looters fighting over each item that they tore from the ruins. Toward late afternoon, the settlers of Masat saw a column of trucks and farm wagons drive into the vanquished settlement. When the column left an hour later, they rushed to study it with binoculars, expecting to see their fellows being carted off to captivity in its vans. Instead, they saw the remnants of the kibbutz itself go rolling past their eyes. Spilling over with goods, the incredible column of pillage stretched on for kilometers. It seemed to one observer that the Arabs were carrying away Kfarat Zion down to the last nails. There were beds, mattresses, cooking utensils, furniture, cows, mules, bales of straw, roofing. Even the Torah of the demolished Neva Ovadia was carted off to decorate some neighboring Arab village. While Kfarat Zion was being carted away, in Tel Aviv, the Council of 13, a body created to replace the Jewish Agency executive and to serve eventually as the provincial government, was meeting to decide if they would proclaim a Jewish state when Britain's Palestine mandate expired. Many of the council favored waiting because they felt it would give them extra time. Those that felt it necessary to proclaim statehood immediately felt that the Arabs would attack regardless of their decision, and by being a sovereign state, they could purchase arms freely, and that any loss of momentum would be fatal. Chaim Weizmann, who had received a secret message from President Truman, warned the supporters of proclaiming statehood, "Don't let them weaken. Don't let them spoil the victory. Proclaim the Jewish state now or never." The message he had received from President Truman had promised him that the United States would recognize the new state immediately and promised all the support that was within the powers of the presidency to grant. To hopefully sway the council to vote for statehood, David Ben-Gurion released information that only he had been privileged to at that time, the totals of the arms that they had been able to purchase in the United States and Europe. They were 30,000 rifles, 5,000 machine guns, 200 heavy machine guns, 67 million rounds of ammunition, 97,000 artillery and mortar shells, 175 howitzers, 30 tanks, 35 anti-aircraft guns, 12 120-millimeter mortars, 50 65-millimeter cannon, and among their aircraft purchased were three B-17 Flying Fortress bombers with a full bomb load. As he spoke, he said that there were arms in the harbor being unloaded from a very unhappy captain. It seemed that unable to find a ship to transport arms to Palestine, the Haganah's European buyer had found a captain willing to take his arms shipment to Istanbul. And then he sent another representative to have a shipment of coal taken to Tel Aviv. Then they loaded the arms first and poured the coal in on top and informed the captain that if he didn't want to take the arms to Tel Aviv, he would first have to go to Istanbul and dig the arms out for himself. The unhappy captain had elected to take the entire content to Tel Aviv. When the council finally voted, by one vote, they elected to declare the Jewish state. The council turned to the consequence of its vote, the protocol of proclaiming a state. Someone suggested that the declaration should stipulate that the state's borders would be those contained within the United Nations partition resolution. Ben-Gurion rejected the idea. The Americans, he said, had not announced the frontiers of their state in the Declaration of Independence, Despite considerable reservations, particularly on the internationalization of Jerusalem, the Jews had accepted the partition resolution. The Arabs had not, and by their action, they forfeited their right to the partition plan. The borders of their state would be those that would come out of the war. "We have before us," he said, "a chance to get a state whose borders will be practical ones. The state we are proclaiming is not the state that resulted from the United Nations decision, but from the de facto situation existing today." Then the group chose a name for the new state. Two names, Zion and Israel, were before them. On Ben-Gurion's urging, the choice finally fell on Israel. One last decision remained, fixing the exact hour at which they would announce to the world the news for which the Jewish people had been waiting for almost two millenniums. Technically, their state would come into existence at midnight, Friday, May 14th, at the end of the British Mandate. But that would be in the midst of the Sabbath, and the Orthodox among them would not be able to travel in an automobile or even affix their signature to a proclamation of statehood at that hour. One of the participants took from his pocket the chart carried by all Jews wishing to be scrupulously exact in their observance of the rites of their religion. Studying its figures, he announced that in order to conclude before the official hour of the setting of the sun, the ceremony proclaiming the birth of a new Jewish nation in the land of Palestine would begin at precisely 4 o'clock Friday, May 14th, 1948, the fifth day of the month of Iyar in the year 5708 of the Hebrew calendar. While the council was preparing to proclaim the Jewish statehood, the three surviving satellites of Kfar at Zion were about to surrender. A fragile ceasefire had been arranged by the Red Cross. When the Red Cross delegation arrived to arrange the surrender, they were swamped in a sea of shouting people before they could even get to the first kibbutz. When they did, its leaders, aware of the massacre that had taken place at Kfar at Zion, insisted on surrendering to the Arab Legion. When the detachment and its transport finally arrived 8 hours later, the surrender began. At each settlement, the Haganah officers refused to hand over their arms until the women and wounded were in the ambulances and their men safely aboard the Legion's trucks. As the trucks rolled off each hill, the prisoners caught their last glimpse of the building in which they had labored so hard. One by one, they burst into flames. Then, like a swarm of locusts, the Arab multitudes descended on their orchards and vineyards, as if to eradicate forever the last trace of that foreign intrusion upon their ancient hills. They tore out by the roots the settlers' young trees, beginning to blossom with the fruit of the first harvest. Friday morning, May 14th, as the British began to leave their buildings, the Haganah were in position to immediately move into them, to the astonishment of the Arabs expecting to do the same. As Raji Sehun proclaimed from his radio broadcasting station, "A new era for Palestine begins today. Long live a free and independent Palestine." He left the station for his new broadcasting station, which had formerly been controlled by the British. As he was driving down the road, in his rearview mirror, he saw the blue and white Star of David already flying over his old station, and the same flag would be flying from the British broadcasting station as he drove up to it. As the British left their hospital, they marched past the Arabs lining the roadway, waiting to take it over. As the last British soldier passed them, they started their walk up the roadway to the hospital, only to stop in their tracks as they witnessed the flag of Israel being raised over it. At the hospice of Notre Dame de France, the Haganah were already scaling the back wall while the British were still departing out the front. One group of Arabs was completely caught off guard. Knowing that the British mandate ended May 15th, they assumed that they would start leaving the morning of May 15th, not the morning of the 14th, and they were all sound asleep as to be well rested for the next morning. Having secured most of the British posts by the afternoon of May 14th, the 200 selected guests gathered themselves for the ceremony that would take place under the portrait of the black-bearded Viennese newspaperman, Theodor Herzl, who had founded the movement that had brought them all together for the historic event. At precisely 4 o'clock, David Ben-Gurion rose and sharply rapped a walnut gavel on the table before him. "In the land of Israel, the Jewish people came into being," he began. "In this land was shaped their spiritual, religious, and national character. Here they lived in sovereign independence. Here they created a culture of national and universal import and gave to the world the eternal book of books. Exiled from the land of Israel, the Jewish people remained faithful to it in all their countries of dispersion. never ceasing to pray and hope for their return and the restoration of their national freedom. Impelled by this historic association, Jews strove throughout the centuries to go back to the land of their fathers and regain their statehood. In recent decades, he reminded his audience, they returned in their masses. They reclaimed the wilderness, revived their language, built cities and villages. It was, he continued, the self-evident right of Jewish people to be a nation as all other nations in their own sovereign state. Accordingly, he said, by virtue of the natural and historic right of Jewish people and the resolution of the General Assembly of the United Nations, we hereby proclaim the establishment of the Jewish state of Palestine to be called Israel. One by one, he set out the principles that would guide the new nations, principles of liberty, justice, and peace as conceived by the prophets of Israel. Full social and political equality for all citizens without distinction of religion, race, or sex. Freedom of religion, conscience, education, language, and culture. Safeguarding the holy places of all religions and the loyal upholding of the principles of the United Nations Charter. We appeal to the United Nations to assist the Jewish people in the building of its state and to admit Israel to the family of nations, Ben-Gurion read. We offer peace and amity to all neighboring states and peoples. Our call goes out to the Jewish people all over the world to stand by us in the great struggle for fulfillment of the dream of generations, the redemption of Israel. With trust in the Almighty, he concluded, we set our hand to this declaration at the session of the Provincial Council of State in the city of Tel Aviv on the fifth day of Iyar, 5708, the 14th day of May, 1948. It was 4:37 p.m. The entire ceremony had taken barely half an hour. Once more, Ben-Gurion picked up his gavel and rapped the table. I hereby declare this meeting adjourned, he said. The state of Israel has come into being. At 12:12 a.m. Palestine time, at 6:12 p.m. Washington time, as promised, the United States announced its recognition of the reborn Jewish state just 12 minutes after the British mandate in Palestine ended. If the Jews of Palestine thought it had been rough before, now that the British were gone, it was to be all-out war as far as the Arabs were concerned. The Egyptian army was already on the move. In the Jewish hospitals and emergency clinics, bandages, plasma, antibiotics, and 2,000 flasks of blood had been divided among the clinics. Water was desperately short. What had been used to scrub wounds was meticulously saved to wash the floors. Since the laundries couldn't work, sheets were taken from the dead to welcome the wounded. As there was almost no electric power, operations were performed by flashlight. Anti-tetanus serum and morphine were almost non-existent. To the nurses of the St. Joseph Clinic, the agony of one young Haganah soldier represented much of the suffering besetting their city. His wounded brother was in the bed beside him. His father had been killed in the withdrawal of Neve Yaakov a few hours before, and he was going to lose both of his legs with his only anesthetic, one shot of morphine, and the blocks of ice with which his heartbroken mother had wrapped his mangled limbs. A few hundred yards away, an Arab doctor would gladly have switched places with those with which he would have thought was a well-stocked clinic. Dr. Ibrahim Thiel had never operated on an abdomen. He had no assistants, and his only nurse was busy elsewhere. As in so many other domains, the confusion and disorder in his improvised hospital were part of the price that the Arabs were paying for their failure to organize their society. Only after repeated warnings from the British and Red Cross had they established any emergency clinic in any of Palestine. The one in which Dr. Thiel was lacked everything. It had no fuel, electricity, water, bandages, blood, or penicillin, anesthetics, plaster, or even food. Volunteers were going from door to door in the old city begging for a jar of kerosene, a box of sugar, a sheet, or a mattress. Its equipment, brought in haste by the young Dr. Thiel himself 3 days earlier, consisted of an antiquated sterilizer, an old operating table, some plasma, penicillin, morphine. Cut off from the government hospital and the other institutions in which they had relied in the new city, the Arabs could offer their wounded little more than a stopping-off place on the way to the grave. Inexperienced, the young Dr. Thiel would have to perform many of his operations as he read them from one of his six enormous volumes of Love and Bailey's Emergency Surgery. The situation in the old city of Jerusalem was desperate. They were out of food, water, and ammunition and unable to attend their wounded. They were going to have to surrender, but they would only surrender to the Arab Legion, and no one knew where they were. Despite the gravity of the situation, there was one source of hope among the solemn faces of the exhausted Haganah soldiers. That source of inspiration was found in a dark-haired 22-year-old English girl named Esther Callingold. Born in London to a devoutly Orthodox household, she had come to Palestine in 1946. She always had a cheery word, no matter how gloomy the situation looked. As composed as if she was still walking the streets of her native London, Esther Callingold moved through the fighting, bringing ammunition, food, and a cheering word to each post. Discovering one day a tray of sandwiches covered with the dust in one post, she quietly admonished its occupants. In England during the Blitz, she told them that they had to learn to make such precious food so it wouldn't spoil. 15 minutes later, she had brought them back a new set of sandwiches, all carefully wrapped. On one of her trips, a ricocheting bullet had struck her in the hip. Insisting that the Arab's attack was too intense to allow anyone to leave a post, she had limped off to the hospital unaided. The Arab radio listed city after city that the Egyptian army was moving through on its march to Tel Aviv. As the Haganah they couldn't believe their ears. All the towns listed were Arab. Again, the lack of communication and organization were hurting the Arabs. The Egyptian army commander had orders to take Tel Aviv. The one giving the orders had assumed that he would conquer everything in his path. The commander of the Egyptian army was doing exactly what he was told, going to Tel Aviv. And not wanting to waste any time or men with the small Jewish villages in the path, he was zigzagging through the Arab-controlled desert to his objective, assuming that someone else would be assigned the task of mopping up behind him. Throughout Palestine, the Arabs were crying for their prized Arab legion, of which no one knew the whereabouts, Arab or Jew. Under intense public pressure and after numerous threats, King Abdullah was forced to order the Arab Legion into Jerusalem. Within the walls of the old city, the men and women were collapsing in battle, many having gone 5 days without food or sleep. And now suddenly the early morning darkness was broken by the blinding flash and the roar of an explosion. John Glove, still hoping to keep his legion out of the battle for Jerusalem, despite his direct orders to do so, had moved some of his artillery onto the ridge outside of Jerusalem, hoping that the shells would do the work asked of his men. But the determined Jews would not give up, knowing that the Arabs would slaughter them. They would rather die of starvation fighting for their homeland. The only one that they would surrender to was the Arab Legion, and the Arab Legion didn't want to get involved while the Jews were still fighting. Finally, John Glove had to send his armored columns into Jerusalem. The rumble of artillery ripped apart the fragile silence shrouding the Judean hills, and throughout the walls of the old city and through the news section, the word spread. The Legion was coming. As the few remaining Haganah officers looked upon the ridges around them, they saw their nightmare. The flashes of the numerous artillery rounds being fired into the city, over the silhouettes of columns of trucks, armored cars, and half-tracks, moving down from the hills towards their city. As the columns began to enter the city, the lead vehicle came to a barricade of stones, logs, and barbed wire blocking the roadway. From the lead vehicle leaped Major Slade and Lieutenant Solemn to clear the way, when suddenly one of their own mortar rounds fell short, killing Lieutenant Solemn and seriously wounding Major Slade. Despite their intense training, centuries of Arab tradition forced the following Arabs to take their fallen leaders and return to the hills. It gave the Jews in Jerusalem what they had needed, time. As the Jews planned for the assault, they had to make a gamble. As the Legion entered the city, would have a choice of going straight and cutting Jerusalem in two, separating the old city from the new. They could go to the right and circle the new city, or they could go left and head for the old city. The Haganah could not defend all three approaches. They did not even know if they could defend one. They would have to guess at which plan the attackers would use and concentrate all their arms there, leaving the rest of Jerusalem undefended. It was decided that they probably would go to the left and take the old city, as it was on the verge of surrender already, and once inside the solid wall of the quarter, they could effectively operate against the rest of Jerusalem. All they had left with which to meet the Legion was two armored cars, a pair of bazookas for which they had 7 shells, one Davidka, named for its inventor, David Leibovich, which was a crude casting which fired a shell consisting of a piece of water pipe stuffed with explosives, nails, and bits of shrap metal, and finally 2 machine guns. Not much to stop the armored columns they were facing.